This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There was that moment, launched by the New Deal and powered by post-war prosperity, where many American workers enjoyed what's now an almost unimaginable sense of stability. Listen back to President Franklin Roosevelt, 1933, saying, "We're all in this together."
We have provided the machinery to restore our financial system, and it is up to you to support and make it work.
And make it work they did. But an honest look at history reveals that such security was actually short-lived. And in fact, almost as soon as workers achieved stability, business leaders, politicians, and economists were making decisions that would upend that security. And why does all this matter now? Well, Louis Hyman says it's those decisions made some 70 years ago, and not technology today, that gave us the gig economy we have right now. This hour On Point, the real birth and story of the gig economy. You can join us on air or online. Do you have an independent job as an Uber driver, a contractor, or a consultant, or a freelancer? Do you like it more than traditional jobs that you had? And then there's this deeper moral question. Can we make the gig economy work for everyone? How do we make flexibility, autonomy, and economic security possible all together? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me now from Washington is Louis Hyman. He's professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University and author of Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. You can find an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Louis Hyman, welcome to the show.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
It's really great to have you. I'm very compelled by this thesis that you have, that the gig economy today is really sort of birthed some 70 years ago. And I want to walk through that history with you. But first, just to sort of give a sense to folks of where we are now. I mean, in the book, you write about how, for example, all the jobs created between 2005 to 2015, 94% of them were in alternative work arrangements. Like, what does that tell us about how big and how growing the gig economy is today?
It's a shocking number, and that's from a study by a Princeton economist. And we basically see that everybody entering the workforce in the last 10 to 15 years has been part of this new economy. And so it's very easy for those who are perhaps later in their careers to be not as fully aware of how this transition has affected young people in particular. So it's a place where there is just tremendous growth.
Right. I mean, speaking of young people, there was a recent study by a company called FreshBooks. They're a cloud-based accounting company and a group called Research Now. And they said that that nearly 27 million contract workers are going to be added to the economy. Contract workers by 2020, so just in like a year and a half from now. 42% of those folks will be millennials. So that's to your point about how young people especially are the workers of the gig economy.
And how you define that gig economy really matters a lot, you know, and how you survey people. So if you ask people if you've participated in this in just the last few weeks, you might get a relatively low number, like the Bureau of Labor Statistics found, about 10%. But if you ask if people have done it in the last year, if you ask, well, is it primary or quote-unquote supplementary, then you get up to 40%. And so we just see a lot of people participating in this economy, this new way of working.
Yeah, so we see the trajectory and where it's headed. But I really wanted to talk to you about sort of how we got to this place. Because I'll be honest, I'd never fully considered even the idea that the gig economy was anything other than technology driven, right?
Yeah.
So take us back to it in time. You really sort of see that the post-war period, post-World War II, has this important fulcrum, right, in how American business leaders and politicians and economists considered, you know, what work is and what the responsibilities of companies are. So take us back to the moment right before that. How would you describe what gave rise to the stability that American workers did feel between, say, 1935-ish to, you know, 1970?
Sure, it's so important to bring this story back. You know, we're told that it's all about apps, but it's actually about the reorganization of work, corporations and work that begins in this moment that defines our lives today. In the 1930s, of course, there was the Great Depression that led into World War II. And so coming out of that, Americans wanted security and stability pretty much more than anything. And during the 1930s, we had great clashes between labor and capital, as we used to call it, where we saw workers begin to organize themselves in new ways through the CIO. The United Auto Workers faced down the largest corporation in the world, General Motors, and demanded a contract. And then a few years later, that is ratified in law. And coming out of World War II, there's a new kind of industrial democracy where everybody is supposed to get a stake in this prosperity. Now, not everyone did, of course. That sort of who was included, who deserved security were white men. Mm-hmm. And that's an important thread through all of this about who gets access to that security. Who counts? Who's inside and who is outside?
I want to talk with you about that more in just a second. But sure. I want to underscore something that you just said, that there was this demand and that demand was met for the security. And that was economic security, I should say, job security. But that was only possible because, as you write in the book, corporate leaders felt something very different about what the purposes of their corporations were than what we may see now. I mean, you talk about how sort of it's a Keynesian slow growth model, which seems utterly foreign from how business is run today.
Well, I think corporate leaders had a very different perspective. They saw themselves as responsible not just to shareholders, but to lots of different stakeholders, to workers, to consumers, to the nation. You know, I think a lot about how Bethlehem Steel in the 1950s shut down a very profitable financial arm because the leaders thought, well, you know, it wasn't finance that beat the Nazis, it was steel that beat the Nazis. And I think there was a broad sense of that we were in this together. And of course, profit was necessary, but those corporations were also very profitable. So this stability for workers and stability for owners and for, you know, managers, all of this sort of fit together. And there was a real collective vision of the long term, an investment in the future.
But again, to remind ourselves, though, as you write about, it's kind of a blink in the eye in when you take the long view of American history and the American economy and the prospects for American workers. And what I find really fascinating about your book is you write that at the same time where finally there's this sense of employment stability in America, to your point earlier, mostly for white men, but at that same time, the forces are put into play to disrupt that stability, right? So tell us the story here of Elmer Winter. He plays a very central role in your book. He's the founder of Manpower, Inc. Who is this guy and why does he matter?
He's a fascinating figure because he is a lawyer that comes out of World War II and one day needs to have a secretary at the last minute to type up his notes for a legal case. And he realizes that he calls all the women who had worked with him. Of course, they're all women, and tried to find somebody at the last possible minute, and he couldn't. And he realizes that he's actually not alone, that this is a tremendous business opportunity. And so he starts Manpower Incorporated in Milwaukee, and then it quickly expands through the next decade and a half, offering emergency replacement workers to corporations. And it starts with secretaries. It starts with women. It starts with married women. It starts with married white women, people who are expected to have security provided for them elsewhere. And it's through this that Manpower begins and expands around the country as the first major temporary agency.
I mean, you write about how some of the temp workers that Manpower offered up were doing some strange things, right?
yes,
like
indeed.
UCLA asked Manpower Incorporated for human guinea pigs to test the effect of smog on the human eye. A French strawberry farmer needed pickers in Lyon, and Manpower didn't necessarily find the workers themselves, but went to a local mental health hospital for inpatients to find workers there. I mean, ask whatever kind of temp a company needed, they were willing to provide it.
Anything you needed could be provided within a couple hours. Just pick up the phone and call, which really pushed back. I mean, for me, really pushes back against this idea that everything's easier with an app.
Right, because we're talking 1948, 1950, the 1960s, exactly. But Winter's deeper point here, as you were saying just a second ago, is that he really pointed to certain inefficiencies that he could root out by using temporary workers, right? I mean, that training and the errors that new workers provide, recruitment costs, all of that. He was unburdening businesses of that by having these women available to do the jobs.
Absolutely. And so he realizes by the 1950s that there is a limit to how many sick people are going to get sick every day in American corporations. And so he begins to think, well, how do we grow if we are not just doing emergency replacement? How can we replace shifts of workers? How can we help corporations manage the cyclical demand for jobs? You know, if we send out, you know, bills at the end of the month, shouldn't we just hire just a few extra people at the end of the month? And so everywhere he looked, Elmer Winter saw opportunity and cyclicality. And so that's where he thought the growth opportunity was for Manpower Incorporated.
Mm-hmm. But also he pointed to whether or not this was actually felt by the temp workers that he hired. I mean, he pointed to the fact that this kind of flexible work maybe helped make the good life possible, right? Especially where you mentioned women before. For women who maybe didn't need or seek permanent employment, but wanted to be in the job market somehow.
So this frames the kind of conversations we have today that,
right,
you know, it's extra work. It's supplementary work. You're not driving that Uber because you need to pay your rent. You're driving it because you just want to get a new PlayStation or go on a trip or something like that. And certainly that's how it was framed in the 1950s, that these were married women whose husbands were providing the real wage. And this was just extras for that extra color television set or redo the rec room or buy a fur. Mm. And so these people were considered to be just extra. And this is the foundational exclusion that makes temporary labor possible.
We're talking with Lewis Hyman. He's author of Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. What lessons does the history of American work have for the future of the gig economy? We'll hear from you when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. States and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Lewis Hyman. He's professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University and author of the new book, Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. He's taking a historian's eye view of how we got to the gig economy we have today. And we're definitely looking forward to hearing from callers who are living in this gig economy in a little bit. But Lewis Hyman, I just still want to march through a little bit of this history here, right? Because before the break, we were talking about Elmer Winter, founder of Manpower Incorporated, and really one of the first companies to bring temporary workers to the economy in a large scale. What fascinates me about him is that you write directly in the opening of the book that he's doing this just at the time where we've finally achieved a sense of job stability in the country, right? I mean, you quote a speech that he gives in 1958 where he talks about deadly fears of the future, that, you know, foreign labor could be a problem, and that foremost in the thinking of every man and woman who works is the basic question, how secure is my job? And he tells businessmen that the dream of economic security is no longer possible, that the old days are gone and plans must be the order of the day. Why did he say that just when we're barely 20 years into feeling that maybe, you know, job security could be a permanent part of the American dream?
He said it because he was selling a service that offered people to replace those permanent workers. And I think this is an important intervention in the history of how this happened, that there were groups of people whose job it was. It wasn't a conspiracy or something like that. It was the choices were made by the people who were being sold a bill of goods, sold a set of ideas about how to organize work and the workplace and the corporation, whether it was Manpower Incorporated or McKinsey and Company. And Elmer Winter tries desperately through the 1960s to sell corporate America on this idea of just letting manpower supply the workers. And he hits, you know, a dead end. It's very hard for him to do that.
So I'm glad you mentioned McKinsey, because obviously Winter is not alone here in trying to change the way Americans work, or how we even think about what work is or should be. Because at the same time, in subsequent decades, you know, we do have other business leaders, business school, influential business school professors, economists, politicians, consulting companies, who together, and as you write very publicly, this isn't a conspiracy, very publicly, are shifting the core contract of what, you know, what the intent and purpose of a corporation should be.
Sure, they're facing, you know, a series of crises beginning in the late 1960s, where it seems like everything's up for grabs. There is the now forgotten conglomerate craze of the 1960s, where, you know, the hottest companies, the things everybody look to, the way that people today look to Facebook or Google, they look to Ling Temco Vought or Litton Industries, these conglomerates that just grew wildly through the 1960s, fueled by debt and fueled by stock swaps and things that you think of as happening in the 1980s. And then they all fall apart in 1969. And this isn't just a few isolated cases. This is 90% of the Fortune 500 had loaded up on debt and become conglomerates. And the sort of unspooling of that comes this crisis of what the corporation means. And into that gap come people like Elmer Winter and Manpower offering new ways to organize work and new ideas about corporate organization coming from leading strategy consulting firms like Boston Consulting Group and McKinsey and Company.
So just for the sake of transparency, you were once a consultant at McKinsey, right?
Yes, and I had a lovely time there. I've also worked as a temp. I have worked as a consultant and a temp. And, you know, I think that it's easy to demonize these people or to say they add no value. But for me, the real question is who's being paid to offer up ideas? And this is what happens. So I think there's been a lot of conversations about economists, their ideas, Milton Friedman, et cetera, but it's McKinsey, it's BCG, it's Manpower, it's PricewaterhouseCoopers that are being paid by these firms millions and millions of dollars to reorganize how everybody works.
Right. I mean, I hear what you say, that a lot of these decisions were made as a reaction to crises, especially in the late 60s and 70s that corporate America might have felt. But there's also the sense that, you know, they're active decisions that are being made. That's the whole purpose of your book, to examine them. I mean,
absolutely.
Was there at any point in time, was there a countervailing force to this sort of aggressive profit maximization trend in corporate America? And if so, why did it not seem to succeed?
It was very curious because, you know, during the 1930s, we have, you know, it seems like the bottom fell out of capitalism. And there was a strong effort by the people of that generation to restore stability and put capitalism on a new footing, to invest in high technology, to channel idle capital, to make sure it benefited the workers, quote unquote. And in the 1970s, there is, instead of containing that instability, there is a doubling down on volatility. There is just a broad popular sense that this is the future, that we should abandon those entitled people of the post-war, and we should enter into a new kind of social contract. And yeah, there was a lot of different ideas. People were pushing for the full employment through the 1970s. And it's also the moment where you start to get new kinds of worker protections like OSHA. And these things, mattered. But it's also at the moment when the leading sector shifts away from Detroit and moves to Silicon Valley, which is an important part of the story as well, where a new kind of corporate organization is pioneered.
Okay, so does that mean then, I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around whether or not the gig economy we have now, and we'll get to the effect that technology is having on it, of course, because that's a huge part of the story. But I'm still sort of grappling with whether or not it was inevitable that we arrived at a place where, as we talked about at the top of the hour, so many jobs are these sort of contract or freelance or gig economy type jobs. I guess what I'm hearing you say is that there were these decisions that corporations made, but I don't necessarily see why it meant that the risks had to all be shunted onto workers.
Absolutely. And there were choices made. There were choices about what is the proper way to run an economy. And at the same time, the leaders of other countries were doing very different things. So, you know, just this past week, there was a large conversation about Elizabeth Warren and arguing for a new vision of the corporation. Well, most of what she's saying has been in Germany since World War II. So, you know, there are other varieties of how to organize capitalism. But in America, because ideas were sold, because of, you know, lots of complicated reasons, these were the ideas that became dominant. And it was partially about, you know, a certain kind of global economy. But more importantly, it was about the virtues and the values that business leaders and policymakers had and the ideas that were sold to justify them.
So, you know, I don't want to be too down on this history because on the other hand, the gig economy today, millions of people are actively choosing to have this kind of employment, right? Because of the upshots, the upshots that Elmer Winter was talking about 60 or 70 years ago. The flexibility, the autonomy, the control over schedule and when and where and how, what you want to do. I mean, these are all powerful motivators and values for individual workers as well. And I also want to step back here and take a note that the gig economy, as we call it, quote unquote, is actually a huge spectrum of jobs, right? I mean, for people who are high paid but contract consultants, you know, they're also in the gig economy. It's working great for them. And then it goes all the way down to the other end of the extreme where, you know, we hear all the stories about ride hailing drivers or, you know, delivery, Grubhub type jobs, that kind of thing where the insecurities are felt keenly.
And even below that, the undocumented workers who have no labor protections whatsoever. So I think that the full spectrum of flexibility runs from people at the very top, you know, independent people with lots of skills, in-demand skills, they make a lot of money, they fly around the world, to people at the bottom who are also moving around the world, but, you know, as economic undocumented migrants. And both of them are essential to the construction of this new economy. And it's important to realize that, you know, for 100 years, the industrial economy didn't deliver the good life either. Mm-hmm. That it was this transformation in the 1930s and 40s where workers demanded better lives and the state guaranteed that made it possible for those 25 nostalgic years for which we're nostalgic now occurred. So I think as we think about autonomy and self-reliance and self-determination, I completely agree. Those are core American values going back to Jefferson. And I write about this in the book. But they're also values that we need to fight for and make sure that even if our jobs are flexible and autonomous, that there is still a measure of security in our lives. And that's what's not being delivered now for lots of people.
Well, we're speaking with Lewis Hyman. He's author of Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. And he's walking us through this very interesting, almost century-long history of how we got to where we are today with the new gig economy. Lewis Hyman really asks an important question, a moral one, about how do we make this new kind of work, this new working economy, work for everyone. And we're going to explore that in a bit. But let's get some callers here. They want to join us. Russell is calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. You're on the air, Russell.
Hi. My question is, and this may be separate from y'all already, maybe I've already covered it, about the American dream. My question was, when I grew up and studied this stuff, I was always taught that the American dream was what Theodore Roosevelt referred to as the freedom from want. Mm-hmm. I don't know if y'all remember that famous Norman Rockwell painting.
Yeah.
The Four mm-hmm. Freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really liking to know, was it a concerted propaganda effort or something that led us to this idea that the real American dream was that everybody is wanting to get rich.
Yeah. Russell,
which of course makes it okay for some to be poor. And of course, and I have to say the way this ties into the gig economy is every aspect of the gig economy I've seen is low wage earners replacing high wage steady earners.
Right. Russell, thank you so much for your call. Lewis Hyman, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think it's the core question because, you know, even for those who get rich, it's kind of a shallow substitute for what I think the real American dream is, which is self-determination. You know, I think a lot about how in the 19th century, it was the dream was to have a farm, be independent, to be on the frontier. But that gets substituted for with a house in the 20th century. But the house is not a site of production. You still have to go to work. You still have to go to an office or a factory. And in a lot of ways, we traded in those, you know, that post-war period, we traded autonomy for security. So even if you got a steady paycheck, it was a paycheck where you had to push paper in an office or turn a wrench on a factory line. And that is soul-breaking work to have that kind of drudgery. And that's certainly the opportunity we're looking for now is how do we restore that kind of autonomy in a digital capitalism that we longed for in an agricultural capitalism that went the way of the dodo in the industrial age. And certainly, this is the important question. What do we want that American dream to be?
Right.
Is it just about money or is it about freedom?
Well, how do we wed that sense, that autonomy with the freedom from want as
exactly.
well? Let's turn to Coy, who's calling from Asheville, North Carolina. You're on the air, Coy.
Hi there, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great. I recently started a handyman business. And before that, I was kind of souped up in the conglomerate of just a general, you know, big box stores and working for them. What I thought was interesting was working for those stores. It gave me the skills, to do the work that I do. And then later it gave me the frustration to get out of that and start my own business. So recently in starting that my own business, you definitely nailed it on the head as to the benefits of being your own worker. But it's just so interesting that that same organizational feel gave me the skills, but also the frustration to become my own boss and do my own thing.
Coy, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Lewis Hyman, what do you think?
I think that this happens for lots of people. I mean, we all have to learn how to do stuff somewhere, right? But I think that's that second part where people want to control their own hours. They want to control their own fate. And we don't do much to support it. So getting back to this question of the American dream, we do a lot to support people buying a house in terms of consumer debt, consumer loans, this and that. It's very hard for small businesses to borrow money. We have the Small Business Administration, but, you know, it's just such a small trickle of money. And it's because we have set it up so it's very easy to securitize consumer debt, and it's very hard to securitize business debt. And that's a policy we can make, and we can make a choice to support people who want to go out and take risks and, you know, get the money they need to do that, as well as, you know, people who need healthcare, who need other kinds of security to become entrepreneurs. And I think that there is this really important middle ground in American culture between liberals and conservatives that has been it's neglected these days. And how do we support people like that?
So I'm really grateful that you're walking us through this history of how we got here, because, I mean, for folks who read the book, they'll find that you very in detail, you go through sort of how each moment that American capitalism has transformed itself. There was a transformation, but how we manage it is really the question, right? And because of technological advancement, because of the smartphone and apps, et cetera, and artificial intelligence coming up soon, the speed at which we're going to have to manage that transition, I think, is perhaps uniquely different than it was before, right? Because the change is upon us now. But Lewis Hyman, you've said that that you believe capitalism, fundamentally American capitalism, and protection from its excesses is really about who counts in this economy, who deserves legal protections, and who deserves economic security. I mean, my question is, with where the gig economy is and where it's going, are we all saying that we think fewer and fewer people actually deserve those protections and that security?
By not talking about it, we absolutely are. We're saying that there are millions and millions of Americans who are not entitled to the same kinds of labor law and employment law protections that we enjoy in our regular jobs. Now, I think that it's important as we move into this gig economy or freelance economy or on-demand economy that we realize that we want people to be entrepreneurs. We want people to take risks and we want people to get paid. And this is the key moral question of our age. And it's important, and this is why historians, I think, can offer something to this conversation, because it's very easy to think it's technologically determined, that it's just about apps, or that corporations or work have never really changed. And what I take pains to do in the book, and other historians do as well, is to say, no, capitalism has changed, has fundamentally, radically changed. In the 19th century, it was based on slavery. In the 20th century, it was based on industrial machinery. In the 21st century, it's based on digital computation, as well as this kinds of flexible labor. So we have choices over how we want our capitalism to go.
Lewis Hyman is with us. He's author of Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. We're grappling with that question that you just heard Lewis ask, the moral question about how do we manage this great transition our economy is going through? How do we give autonomy and security to everyone? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, y'all. I'm Sam Sanders. I host an NPR show called It's Been a Minute. Every Friday on the show, I talk out the week of news. Because sometimes the best way to process everything going on right now is through good conversation. Download the show, and we'll process everything together.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Lewis Hyman. He's author of Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. He's walking us through the history, the long history of how American work has been changing since the post-war era and how we arrived at the gig economy we have today and what that means for the choices we had as a society have for the future. I'm going to get to some callers here in just a second, but Lewis Hyman, there is something about your book that I wanted to ask you about here, because you've written or you've said that you know, the speed of this change is, well, I guess this is me saying it, I believe the speed of the change is being accelerated because of technology. But you've said that you want us to learn from our history, because when things like artificial intelligence do come and replace jobs that we previously thought were irreplaceable, it will be a moment of liberation. Are you really so optimistic about that?
I guess I am. I think it's important to be optimistic, because only with optimism can you imagine a future that turns out better than the dystopias and that were offered in science fiction. I think that it's important to realize the closest analog to artificial intelligence is probably the mechanical thresher, if you really want to look at historical examples, something that came in and just displaced millions of people. You know, most Americans in the 19th century were farmers, and now less than 2% are. And it's one of the most highly automated areas in our economy. But it also means that you and I aren't going out to collect the wheat every fall, and we can do other things. Now, this set in motion all kinds of social dislocation. It led to the populist movements of the late 19th century. But it also enabled us to do things that were more human, that were less, you know, basically raw physical beasts of burden. And I think that's what we should try and solve for, that we're trying to figure out, well, how do we become more human in this transition? How do we focus on the things that make us human, more caring, caring for each other, more curious, as opposed to doing the soul-deadening work of paperwork or other kinds of labor that nobody really does by choice in their free time.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas most of us would prefer to care for the elderly or our children or go fishing than actually fill out another form. So I think that's part of what we're trying. I'm trying to get at in the book is
Yeah, so I just sorry for jumping in here, but I want to say, first of all, that I am heartened by your optimism.
Because
without hope, what point is there to try to effect positive change here? But if I may, I myself, I don't really share that optimism. In fact, I'm a little pessimistic, and here's why. And this relates to the history that, you've shared with us. Because it seems to me right now that the very people who are introducing this the new world of artificial intelligence or, you know, technology-driven change, et cetera, they're the folks who are making the decisions to use it, to launch it into new places in how Americans work, they are the ones who will not be replaced by this technology, right? So
True. You're
asking for enlightened corporate and political leadership, and I'm just not sure it's there because there are still too many perverse incentives that keep those decision makers, you know, blind or even inured to the effects of the change that they're foisting on everyone. I mean, in your book, you wrote, quote, "No one else at the top was committed to the long haul, so why would they be committed to job security for anyone else?" And that was regarding the 1970s. So what's different today?
So, yeah, absolutely. And your pessimism is also justified. I think that, you know, the kinds of apps we see are – but I think it's important to realize that the apps and the sort of on-demand economy like Uber are not creating this condition, right? They are taking advantage of it. Uber is the waste product of the service economy, that the alternative to Uber is not having a good union job or having a secure job in an office. It's slinging lattes at a Starbucks, wondering if you're getting enough hours that week. And this is why it's also important to look back to the 1930s. It wasn't just enlightened despotism or enlightened corporate leadership, however you want to call it. It was workers demanding an alternative. And so it's workers, you know, we think of the AFL-CIO as one organization now. Well, the CIO broke away from the AFL in the early 30s to organize the industrial workforce, as opposed to old types of craft workers like carpenters and bricklayers. And it's through their auspices that this new social compact is made. So it's corporate leaders, but in the face of overwhelming power from workers. And so today, as we try to reimagine this new world of work and how it can empower workers, empower this kind of entrepreneurship and autonomy, we need to also realize that it's not just about passing laws and not just about people being nice to each other. It's about power and figuring out how to organize workers and workers' voice for the 21st century. And there's a lot of people trying to do this in different ways, from digital hiring halls to platform cooperativism. But I think that's the important key here, that it's not just about being nice to each other. It's about organizing with each other.
So you're dancing around a word that starts with you, but I will go to Paul, who's calling from Centerville, Maryland, to ask that question. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi there. Actually, I called before the speaker or you got to talking about unions. And it seems to me, in retrospect, I'm in my 70s, lived through the 50s, and listened to my parents and grandparents talk about the 30s and 20s. It's my perception that what was just being said, nothing is going to change until there is a complete balance of power. The industry and management abused that strength they had back in the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, and it wasn't until the 20s, 30s, 40s, and probably through the 50s that unions were really, really powerful, and they put management in its place. In other words, balanced the power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think until that occurs, nothing will change. It'll just be, yes, you'll have very technical kind of contract jobs people will have, but they'll still have no pensions. They'll have none of this. They'll have no one to manage their retirement plans and things, which I guess are large in my older mind.
It should be large in young people's minds too, Paul. But Paul, let me take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. I mean, Lewis Hyman, Paul said balance, and I think that's a really important mm-hmm. framing to this part of the conversation. Because I mean, union membership continues its long-term decline in the United States. There's also been, you know, many recent legal rulings and sort of political animus to unions in America. I mean, are there other models? Maybe you were touching on some of them before, but other sort of 21st century models of organization that can provide that balance that Paul was talking about?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, it's important to realize that unions in the 1920s were dead, that the AFL was just puffing along on fumes. And it was only in the 1930s as they said, look, we're not going to organize by craft. We're going to organize by industry. We're going to organize by how capitalism is organizing, by how corporations are organizing. So instead of going to GM and saying, well, we want to organize your carpenters and your bricklayers, we want to instead saying, we're going to organize the whole place, whether it's skilled workers or unskilled workers. And every time before then, it had failed in the 19th century. So this was a radical break between the AFL and CIO, who didn't recombine until 1955. So as we think about models for worker power today, of worker empowerment as institutions, we have to realize that labor unions need to reflect how companies are being organized today. And it's by supply chains. It's by distributed workforces. And it's very hard, given our current organizing models and our current legal regime, to organize that way. Yet, if unions are going to have a voice in the 21st century, whether it's the AFL-CIO or something else, they have to reflect the new organization of business. And that's an important part of this rebalance of power.
Let's go to Anastasia, who's calling from Orlando, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to agree with what Paul said about the balance. I think that that's so important. And I would like to further state that I wonder if we really have ever truly had capitalism. Because during the Industrial Revolution, we know that Rockefeller really became very powerful through a lot of dirty deals. And then in order to clean up his name, he became a philanthropist. And so he was able to buy a lot of bang for his buck. He got a lot of power over the education system, a lot of power in the business world and everything, and made a cleaner name for himself. If you look nowadays at the corporations, they are so in bed with the government that they can pretty much get whatever they want.
Uh-huh.
There are six corporations that own 90% of the media. That's been proven. As far as freelancing goes, I think a lot of people really don't have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, the corporations have so much power and so much power in the way that they treat people. And a lot of them will only hire part-time so that they don't have to pay for health benefits.
Yep.
And on the flip side of that, they might hire them for a full-time, but then make them work while they're off the clock.
Anastasia, thank you. I'm going to take it back from you. Thank you so much for your call there. I mean, Lewis Hyman, what's your response to Anastasia's point that she's not sure balance can ever be achieved, not just because of corporate power, but the combination of corporate and government power?
It's hard. Look, corporations are very powerful. They're organized. They have incentives. And capitalism has always been an engine for growth as well as an engine for inequality, right? So that money tends to accumulate within the hands of the few. And it's only by, you know, countervailing forces that, as they used to call it, that we're able to make that prosperity, that productivity work for everybody. And we've only done that in few points in our time. And I think that this flexibility, as it's termed now, is really one-sided. It's the flexibility of an employer to tell you when your hours are going to be, right? It's the algorithms that determine how to minimize the shifts that workers get so they don't go over that part-time limit. And so I think as we move forward, we're going to have to figure out ways through law, through institutions, through social norms to redress those kinds of incentives.
But
it's been a long time since we've had a balanced capitalism in this country.
You also, I guess some might say that we never did have it, but you also offer a completely different possibility for the future in the book, right? I mean, you say that what's truly shocking, quote, truly shocking, is how wage labor and the corporation itself might be in retreat, because in a flexible gig economy, why does anybody need a boss now? Tell me more.
I think what's pretty shocking to me, so, you know, when I try to look at AI or these other kinds of technologies that happen today, broadly, they seem very much like what had happened before in terms of substituting physical or mental power through a machine for a human. We've always encoded skills into machines, right? That's what most of the assembly line is about. What seems really new to me is this possibility that the individual can sell, the individual can consume, the individual can connect at a global level without this intermediary of the corporation. And this is what's truly novel and interesting to me about our moment today. And whether that becomes a race to the bottom or a new sort of liberation from the tedium of work, from the tedium of the workplace and a boss. And, you know, I think that we shouldn't just discount that. I think that is for, as surveys reflect, for a lot of people who are satisfied in their freelance job. This is the big point.
Right. So, Lewis Hyman, I really am curious what you think about this, that this is a profound question, especially for American capitalism, right? Because I think the gig economy or the freelance flexible economy, whatever you want to call it, presents two different faces of things that Americans deeply value. On the one hand, you know, the autonomy, the entrepreneurship, the flexibility, the ability to be your own boss, very core American desires. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, in order to make it work, again, to get to that moral question you're talking about, to provide stability, you know, retirement, healthcare, housing stability, all those kinds of things, I'm not sure that can happen without some kind of legal framework, laws, government interventions, policies, etc. And Americans don't really like government interfering or pushing itself into those kinds of aspects of our lives. I mean, just think of the pushback that we're still having over the Affordable Care Act. So how do you reconcile the two?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, especially with the language we use about government today as something meddling in our, you know, real markets, meddling in our lives. But government hasn't always been like that. And certainly, again, going back to the 1930s, and I apologize for those who are traumatized by sounding like a history class, but I think it's really important.
It's a history book. That's why
it's
we're
a history
here.
Book. Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, the things that really worked were these partnerships between the state and businesses and labor. It was a coalition of labor leaders and business leaders that brought about the mechanism, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, that channeled all the idle capital of Wall Street in the 1930s into these loony new tech areas that were called aerospace and electronics, and set the stage for all the prosperity of the post-war. And right now, we have trillions of dollars just sitting idle in our bank accounts, in our banks, that should be channeled into new industries, into small business, and we're not doing that. So, you know, obviously states can be bad. States can also be good. It's really about how we use them. The technology is neutral, whether it's, you know, an app or the corporation, you know. So how do we make it work for us?
But, you know, I mean, to take your point about the historical example of all the post-war development that happened, but post-war is the key. There was a war, right, that helped launch America down this path. And I'm just wondering, like, can we achieve that same kind of cooperation? We just got about 30 seconds left here.
Yeah.
Without a precipitating crisis, right?
Like, yeah, people often say it's the war. Well, there's been lots of wars. There was World War I, and the end of World War I ended in, a giant recession for rural America. So the question is, how do we have that collective sense? How do we have that sense of will and purpose? You know, is it climate change? Is it the moral crisis of seeing all these people wasting their lives unemployed? Is it the sort of question about the despondency of diseases of despair? I think it's the question of how do we act collectively as Americans to empower ourselves and our economy? And that is, that hopefully doesn't require war at all.
Well, Lewis Hyman is professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell and author of Temp, How American Work, American Businesses, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Lewis Hyman, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And by the way, we've got an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. And before we wrap up here today, I just want to say one quick thing, how honored I am to be with you on this show and be with the incredibly deeply intelligent team here on this first day of a new chapter for On Point. I got my journalistic start at this program as a producer many years ago, and it's here where I learned to love research and how to seek the most incisive questions. And those core values of intelligence and depth have informed my entire career. They are the values that make On Point great. As you know, David Folkenflik will be at the helm on Fridays. You already know how smart he is, so expect to hear many conversations from both of us that mix urgency and humanity with some new takes as well. As David says, On Point is democracy in action. We're privileged to take part in that action with you. So let's get to work. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Thank you.